The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with Furious Pertinax, who is an Australian commentator. I've wanted to have him on for several years, but it hasn't been possible until now. So I'm glad that we can do this now. So Furious, welcome to Millennial for the first time.
Thank you, mate. I appreciate the invite. Like you say, we've sort of tried to line this up for the last couple of years, but it hasn't quite panned out. But indeed, here we are. And I have to say that I feel quite almost overwhelmed that I'm sort of like bookended by Uncle Jared and Blackpilled. I'm in a awesome company, and I feel like I have big shoes to fill. So we'll do our best, right?
Yes. Yeah, don't worry about it. The important thing is to just be yourself.
Indeed, as I always strive to do on these streams. So, but thank you, Woz. I'm very humbled by your invite. And I've loved your show for many, many years. I mean, I still remember back in the days when this used to be on YouTube, right? And you used to just have all these guests, and you know, it was always a cozy lead up to Christmas, just listening to Woz and Co. And now I'd like to be a part of it. It's actually quite the honor. So, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for what you just said. It's nice. I mean, obviously, it was great when it was all on YouTube and everyone was there in one place. But that's not possible for me nowadays. And you know, some people have said, why don't you just create a sock account? Because it would last about 10 seconds. You know, it's just not a realistic thing. So we do it on these other platforms now. And it seems to work out fine. I mean, people do seem to enjoy this. I don't even see people lamenting and saying, oh, I wish it was on YouTube. It seems to be doing fine. Okay, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience for anyone who hasn't heard of you?
Sure. Well, I suppose because he's been on for the last couple of years, I take it your audience would be familiar with Apostolic Majesty. And and yeah, it's actually quite an accident how our paths sort of crossed. He sort of came onto the scene, if memory serves me correct, that he sort of jumped on UO one time because it was sort of this discussion about is the East Roman Empire in fact Roman? And funnily enough, a friend of mine, Settlers and Lent, sort of said, oh, bring this guy on because, you know, that's his area of study, which it is. I'm technically a Byzantist. And I actually didn't get a spot on that UO, which I was miffed about. But of course, I watched the show. I end up watching the stream. And of course, this Apostolic Majesty surfaced. And I was deeply impressed with his work. And then he sort of introduced his channel with sort of like a mini series. I think it was like 10 streams of, you know, a very sort of broad brush, epochal sort of brush of history. You know, like there's a stream on, you know, ancient Rome, and a stream on Byzantium, and then a stream on, you know, Renaissance Italy. And, you know, and then I think he even bookends it with like Il Duce Zero in Italy. And sort of after that miniseries had completed, I actually just thought to message him on Twitter. I was like, oh, listen, I'm deeply impressed with your work. You know, it's actually nice to see or listen to history that's sort of told from a perspective that is not contaminated by the modernist mindset. And then he sort of replies back. He goes, oh, well, I'm about to start a series, or two series rather, one on the Greeks and Orthodox history, and one on the nations of Charlemagne, and you know, are you free next Monday? And that's really the origin story of how I sort of wound up in these spheres, which I have to say, to this day, I'm still eternally grateful for, because many of us in this sphere, and I mean, you undoubtedly are among this cadre, whereas you, in fact, you predate us by several years. But many of us do this for, you know, the love of it. You know, I know there's often accusations. People say, oh, like, oh, this guy's a grifter, this guy does this guy does that. But I think a lot of us genuinely enjoy it, whether it's commentary or whether it's, you know, discussions on politics, whether it's, you know, retelling history or, you know, whatever sort of our respective niches. And yet sort of everyone has a place. And I think that's worth mentioning, you know, like something like yourself has a particular place, something like AA, Academic Agent, has a place, and someone like, you know, Semigog has a place, and, you know, Jay Burden and Charlemagne and Apostolic Majesty, etc. And I think it's sort of, we make for a really intriguing community in that way. And so, yeah, like, just to have like my own little humble jigsaw piece in that puzzle is actually quite humbling. But yeah, that's sort of how it came to pass. And then not long after that, AA invited me onto UO, because it was actually sort of in the midst of the whole COVID lockdown shenanigans, and for anyone who sort of followed that remotely closely, Australia was one of the worst places to endure it.
I should just clarify for anyone who doesn't know this, UO is Unpopular Opinions, which is Academic Agent's panel show every week.
Yes.
Just for anyone who doesn't know that, Australia seemed like a nightmare. It seemed like a police state. Well, it basically was a police state during COVID.
Yeah. I've told the anecdote of people where I knew of a professional, like a white collar person, who he was accosted by rangers for walking his dog on a path like next to a beach. I mean, you know, and then the dog, you know, funnily enough, a golden retriever, mind you, a very docile breed, barked at the ranger, and then he wound up in the back of a police wagon. I mean, you know, for a so called free democratic nation, I mean, could you think of anything more appalling?
That is incredible. Mm. But there were incredible things, you know, especially from Victoria. Over the West. I mean, I think about this, whenever I think about COVID, there are two things that come back to me in particular as epitomizing the absurdity. And one of them is these backpacks that I'll try to find out if I see now that I've got to find the damn photos in amongst all the things, it's going to be very difficult. Here's one of them. It was some guys going around with these screens attached to them. This was in England.
Yeah.
I mean, what on earth? It's absolutely bizarre. Two guys walking around like that, like sort of walking billboards. And then
Literally, Orwell could have dreamed of this when he sort of wrote 1984. Like, the idea of a television, like, a, you know, one of those projected things in the home was horrific enough. Never mind guys in masks walking around with teleporter screens. Like,
yeah.
That's just like Orwell on steroids, right?
Yeah. And then there was another one that I was going to show, which is a park bench that had been completely festooned with... here it is.
Is that the one with the partitions, so people can't sit next to each other?
Or something like that?
Oh, okay, wow. Jeez.
I mean, how thorough could you be in terms of just telling people you are not going to enjoy a sit-down in the park? Awful. And then the third one that I hadn't thought of.
Sorry to interrupt, Woz, but just to make the point too, there are functionaries, both the people who did this and the people who ordered it to be done, who enthusiastically went along with this madness. And people like us should never, ever, ever forget that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that one was in Germany, I should say. This guy's in England. And this third one, perhaps the worst thing about this photo is that it could be in any country. And wait till you see it.
Yeah, wow.
And I don't want to depress everyone, but as I say, this one appeared to me when I was scanning through the folder for the other two. This is just an appalling image of globalism. Every aspect, everything there,
it's the bench, personified, right?
Sorry?
It's the GAE just personified in a single photo, right? You know?
Yes, it really is. even down to the advert on the bench with the black guy, yeah. You know.
And of course, like a McRestaurant is guarded by, you know, like National Guard, because it's the only thing that's sacred to the regime.
Yeah. If you try to steal a burger, you're going to get some lead.
Yeah. Wow.
Just awful. So yeah, there you go. But enough of such things. I don't want to get people down. I just brought that in to remind people of how awful life was 3 years ago in the midst of all of this.
And the sheer madness of the two. You know, I suppose to circle back to what you were asking about, you know, what sort of my side of it was, you know, I was fortunate that I do come from a family of farmers, of agriculturalists. I mean, hence the moniker sort of in the name, right? I mean, people think it's a piss take, but it's actually like fact. You know, it's actually what I do is in my, you know, real life existence. And we managed to sort of just, you know, pack our bags and, you know, spend the better part of a year in the countryside, which was good because when I was doing work out in the fields, you know, I didn't have to wear a bloody mask and, you know, the vax mandates hadn't actually quite come through yet. You know, throughout 2021 at least. But something did actually happen in 2022, which appalled me, was that I don't know what the system's like in Britain, but in Australia, we have these sites dotted all through the countryside, and they're basically the sort of like grain depositories, and whether you grow like canola or wheat or barley, whatever, you know, you obviously harvest your crops in your fields, and then the grain goes into these big silos, and then from the silos they're put into trucks and they're transported to these depositories. We call them bins in Australia, but that's irrelevant. In order for either a contractor or a farmer to deliver to these depositories, they actually had to be vaxxed in 2022, not 21, but in 2022. And it was amazing how, you know, because often in our circles, and for instance, I love how AA does talk about this, because he does get to the nub of these points quite particularly, is that the decisions of these regimes are sort of very much, or not in all cases, but in the majority of cases, are very much class-based. And we all know that, you know, whether we want to call them internationalists or globalists or, you know, or the regime or whatever, the GAE, one class of people they've always deeply resented and deeply mistrusted is what, you know, to use the Russian allegory, a kulaks, you know, is the farmers, because they're the people probably most capable of self-sufficiency. And the fact that you could be hundreds of kilometers from a major city, and indeed tens, if not dozens of kilometers away from your closest town, right, which could be as few as this population could be as few as 1,000 people, or even less, in the case of Australia particularly. And no, they have to pass a jab mandate just so they can, you know, get this stuff into your veins is appalling. And then all these so-called like federations and institutions and, you know, like what do you call them? Like representative groups who are meant to act on behalf of farmers just roll over like dogs. Like, they don't actually represent the interests of their people. And when push comes to shove and the squeeze is brought upon them, they just relent. And it was one of the things that really, how can I put this? I mean, I have the sort of views that I have. I had the views then that I have now. It's not like that's really changed. But you might say my belief in the common man did diminish throughout the COVID experience. And there's a lot of people who chose expediency and who chose, you know, just getting on with it over, firstly, principle and also personal sovereignty. That they would substitute risking the health of the rest of their lives for the sake of obeying what is what was an unjust, deeply unjust policy brought about by our governments. So that sort of shocked me in my personal situation, woes, for whatever that matters. And you know, and yeah, just you know, sort of seems like one thing after another. You know, probably another thing that solidified my thinking was the outcome of, you know, the 2020 election and Jan 6 and what sort of has occurred under the, shall we call it, Biden's pseudo-administration, because it's not really sort of him at the moment. He's a husk of a man. But, you know, once, you know, to watch a complete cheating of an election, whatever hope one might have had in democracy as a legitimate form of governance, completely went out the window. So, I mean, I'm sure I'm preaching to the converted here, but you know, those events really stick in the mind of in terms of solidifying a worldview, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. How did the BLM thing land in Australia, so to speak? I mean, George Floyd in 2020, because mm-hmm. that's the yeah. third big thing of 2020 for me. Mm-hmm. Well, second chronologically. But,
absolutely.
Did it manifest much there?
It didn't have the fervor that it had in the USA. And you know how sort of one of the boomer copes is that it's like, oh, it's a loud minority, and it's just, you know, it's you know, uni students who will grow out of it and that sort of nonsense, which, as people like us know, is categorically untrue. Or at least for the most part, it's untrue. But in Australia, that sort of is essentially how it played out insofar that it was just a small band of, you know, ideological radicals and their sort of, how should we say, like their ethnic pets. And, you know, placards are sort of, you know, drawn and, you know, shoved in people's hands and, you know, stand outside Parliament and wave a few things. And, I mean, for instance, there were statues of Governor James Stirling and of James Cook that were not sort of damaged in the structural sense. They weren't, like, defaced or beheaded or anything or torn down like we saw in particularly the USA. But there was a little bit of, you know, like, paint throwing and a little bit of, you know, ruckus like that. But nothing permanent, at least to my knowledge. Some other Australians, if anyone's watching, if I'm mistaken, by all means correct me. But to my knowledge, nothing particularly egregious happened. But, you know, again, it's, you know, you're talking about just scales of severity here. It's the fact that you actually have this cadre of malignant people in your society that attacks its heritage and attacks its cultural foundations and its founding mythos, essentially, is disconcerting nonetheless. But thankfully in Australia it was much more low key. But I have to say, you know, even though I'm obviously Australian, I obviously discuss my Italian heritage as well, as you're probably familiar with woes. And what was interesting is that I contrasted it to the experience in Italy, because I actually, in fact, I have much more Italian family than I do Australian family. And not a single statue in Italy was touched. And I've always remarked that, you know, the day that, just before I go on, can I ask a question, woes? Have you ever traveled to Rome before, as in like the city? Have you been there before?
No.
Okay.
I unfortunately not. I've been to Milan about maybe somewhere mm-hmm. between 5 and 10 times. I was in Verona earlier this year, which was just lovely.
Very beautiful, right? I was there in 2019. It's a lovely place.
Yeah, but I've never been farther south than that mm-hmm. In Italy.
So you're avoiding the Swathoids on purpose. Yeah.
Well, since you've brought it up, I have a hilarious meme about Italy. Sure. I'll see if I can find it. But oh yeah, here it is. There you go.
Yeah. I've seen that a million times. Mind you, that being said, how much of a chat is what's his name?
Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, Dolph Lundgren, yeah.
Apparently he's very high IQ as well.
He's a chemical engineer.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And actually he actually got his degree in Sydney University, by the way. For people who might not know, yeah,
I know.
It's actually part of how he became famous. He was a bouncer at a nightclub, and they were doing the premiere for which Bond movie was it? View to a Kill. And Grace Jones like was at this nightclub, and that's how they like struck up a relationship. And then he finished his degree, and then he like went to the US. He always had to live with her, and then he was like an extra in one of the Bond movies, and then Stallone saw it and went, wow, I want that guy to play Drago. And that's basically how his career started.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Well, anyway, to get back to the
matter. Sorry for celebrity gossip.
No, it's an interesting tangent there.
Yeah.
So I've never been further south than that. And that's something I'm not proud of. And I would like to... I'd definitely like to... I mean, I don't... See, I'm a quarter Italian in terms of ancestry, but genetically, 8%, only 8% for some reason. But I don't see myself as, I mean, I would never say I'm an Italian. That would be absolutely ridiculous. So it's not like I feel it's part of my identity. It just isn't really, it's just not there enough to be that. However, it is a country that I'm attached to in a sense, and it's a country that I have a lot of fondness for, just like anyone could. So, yeah, I want to explore it more. I mean, it's people make fun of it a lot, you know, especially with the South North thing. But
it's fortunate that we have a good sense of humor, at least.
Yeah, and it's a different way of living. It's a more relaxed, laid back way of living. Mm-hmm. It's a more commonsensical sort of way of living compared to the uptight and you could say self-righteousness of
and slightly highly strung.
Highly strung, neurotic, very given to political correctness of the Northern Europeans. So yeah, it's a different thing, a different culture.
Yeah, exactly. And anyone who exists in our circle, I mean, I would implore you to at least once in your life travel. Firstly, travel to Italy, sort of writ large, but most definitely go to Rome. I mean, Rome is without question one of the quite literally foundation stones of Western civilization, and I think an alternative reality by which Rome isn't a preeminent power in the ancient world. I mean, I suppose we'll touch on history later, but just because we're on this topic, our entire history looks different in some cases for better, because I say this to someone who I'm quite the admirer of Gallic and Celtic culture, certainly like as an Iron Age civilization. And in some cases, you know, for the better. I mean, you know, we have, you know, the Romans to thank for, you know, considerable technological and, you know, and planning achievements. Like just even the idea, for example, of, you know, the idea of being a citizen to a nation state, it's sort of origin point, its context lies in the Roman concept of civitas, of being a citizen of Rome. You know, that's how far back its origins go, you know, as a mere concept. And, you know, without Rome, we wouldn't have many of those things, you know, and plus, you know, the European law and Latin alphabet, sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is why I just can't understand it when people say, and, you know, I'm thinking of E. Michael Jones, when he says that Europeans, without Christianity, we were just barbarians and ignoramus, just, you know, like apes. And this is just so patently untrue. I don't know how I really don't know what's going on in his head when he says things like that. And I don't mean to attack E. Michael Jones when he's not here to defend himself. But I do think that kind of thing is it's just a silly thing to see.
It comes from an erroneous sort of illogical place. That's the problem. And I mean, I don't want to have a dig at him either, because like you say, he's not here to defend himself. But this is where, and I suppose I just make this point by and large, is that there's a distinction to be made between the religiosity of a people and some of the cultural qualities that come with following a religion. As in, you know, if you're Japanese, there are certain tenets of Shintoism that are reflected in Japanese culture and are lived, you know, expressed by the Japanese people who live their lives according to those principles, right? That is also true of Buddhists. That is true of the Hindus of India. That would have been true of the Persians prior to the conquest of Islam in the 7th century. Like Zoroastrianism is a very sort of Persian, you know, it's a very Persian conception. And you know, them and the religion sort of very much are expressions of each other, and they sort of coexist. You know, it's true, for instance, of us in the West, you know, to a certain degree of Christianity. And prior to Christianity, you know, you have the Celtic civilization and the religion that sort of coincided with the Celts. And then also the sort of Hellenic pantheon that Rome and Greece adhered to, which likewise they were cultural expressions of. So there is a religious influence to it, but that doesn't supersede a civilization and the people that comprise of that civilization. And I don't think someone like E. Michael Jones that has actually spoken to people who have a depth of knowledge about civilization beyond a superficial level. And I think that shows in his opinion on that matter. I could be mistaken, but that's how I interpret it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you wanted to talk about was the importance of history. And it's ironic that we've sort of arrived.
Sorry, Wes. Sorry, can I? I was going to say, because I asked you if you traveled to Rome before, because that was about BLM. I just want to finish my point. If we go back,
sure.
Sorry. Is that not a statue was touched in Rome or in Italy? Like nothing was vandalized. None of that sort of American poison, you know, was expressed in Italy. I mean, people might have grumbled or said stuff on social media or whatever, but none of it was had. And I joked amongst friends and even like, you know, even amongst our friends on the internet here is that the moment, because the reason I asked you about Rome specifically is in outside the forum, as in like the old ruins of the forum, which are still present in Rome, and you know, any of us who haven't been should go. There's a statue of Julius Caesar, and it's so revered by the modern day Romans that every day on his birthday, Romans still, you know, 2,000 years after Caesar lived and died, they still lay flowers at his feet on his birthday every year. He's still revered amongst Romans. And I sort of joked, I mean, I hope it never happens for obvious reasons, but I kind of joked that the day that Italian Antifa or the Italian sort of left are dumb enough to vandalize Italian statues, they will quite literally carry the next Il Duce to power on their shoulders, because Italians do have a cultural cognizance and a fidelity to their history that I think a lot of Europeans don't have.
Yes,
In terms of the dot points we covered, I know we're going to touch on Boomer Truth at some point later in this discussion, but I think, for instance, the Italian experience and the German experience in the post-war period offer a little insight as to why that's the case. But let's bookmark that for now and move on to the point that you mentioned, because I did interrupt you, so I apologize. It's just that I wanted to get to that before we moved beyond.
Yeah, I understand. You're quite right. Well, the matter of the importance of history. We live now in a time when especially young people are very obviously in ignorance of their history. But I think also older people as well, in a different way, and we'll get to that later. But the importance of history, well, how do you even begin such a matter? It's obvious that there is no real perspective without a historical grounding. Without that, what you're doing is existing in all you can think of is logistics. All you can think of is what's for the what makes sense, what is efficient, what is most acceptable, most palatable, I guess. But there are no actual priorities. There's no transcendence, because you yourself are not grounded in anything transcendent. The point really of teaching history is to take you out of the here and now, and to make you see yourself as part of something huge and meaningful, and that transcends your life, your lifespan. So without that, I think, yeah, we end up as just consumers. And I think that is what is desired by the powers that be today. Would you like to take this?
Yeah, sure. Actually, funnily enough, I was just watching, as I'm sure you're aware, every so often, Academic Agent sort of uploads or replays his retrospectives, you know, of certain sort of cigar streams that he's done.
Yes, I was watching one just the other day, yeah.
Yeah, so for instance, what just jumps to mind is that one of the recent ones he did only a couple of days ago, he actually directly quoted, because it was the PSA Sitch argument thing that he had with them, and in one of the refutations he did, he quoted Herbert Marcuse, and it was interesting that he sort of referenced the fact that Marcuse talked about how normalizing degeneracy, or normalizing sort of sexual deviancy and attacking, you know, the family unit and tearing down these presiding social expectations or standards in this instance, specifically regarding sort of sexuality and sexual conduct and how that interplays with, social stability, because of how the family unit counteracts those things, or how monogamy counters those things, etc. If you didn't have a historical grounding, you know, someone could, you know, for the sake of the example, like hypothetically speaking, walk into a Herbert Marcuse lecture and just like, oh, okay, that idea might have merit, or oh yeah, actually, you know, let's try that. But if you have a historical background where you've read, you know, someone like John Bagot Glubb, or you've read Gibbon, and you look at, and this is where broad and deep civilizational perspective matters, is because if you look at ancient Rome, and when I say ancient Rome, I don't even mean like the empire. I'm talking like the early republic. I'm talking when, you know, Rome is in a relentless battle for supremacy over the Italian peninsula with its sort of immediate neighbors, where it's sort of fighting Umbrians and Samnites and, you know, the Greeks in the south, you know, Tarentum and the city-states, and it's fighting the Etruscans and, you know, these sort of people. Is that, you know, what made Rome distinct from those people? Well, I could probably sit here for a whole hour talking to you about that. So I'll spare you and your audience. That's another conversation for another day. But the fact is that the Romans did prevail over their immediate neighbors. And there is sort of something to the Romans that sort of, you know, made them better than their immediate neighbors. And it made them supreme in their immediate proximity, which sort of led to firstly being a local power, and then, you know, a power within Italy itself, if to use it as a geographical reference, then a regional power against, when it came into contention with Carthage and the Punic Wars. Then it sort of became the power of the Western Mediterranean. And then within sort of another two centuries, it becomes a Mediterranean and essentially European power. It's basically, you know, Europe without Germany plus the Near East and North Africa. What were the qualities that led to Rome being able to do that? And if you look if you look back at, you know, ancient sources, if you look back at the sources of the times, and it's, you know, it's interesting that even when Rome's sort of approaching its zenith, and its zenith is somewhere, you know, you could probably draw a line between sort of Sulla and Marius, which is sort of like first century, it's like 100 BC thereabouts, to about the period of the five good emperors. So you're talking, you know, like Trajan, Hadrian, Marcus Aurelius, you know, and that's sort of like, you know, 100, 150 AD. Is that sort of already then they were sort of relying on the inertia that their predecessors had established in Rome. But nonetheless, they were able to achieve this sort of material and physical zenith. But even sort of in that period and just sort of leading up to that period, you have writers like Cicero. You have writers like, I'm trying to think of who critiqued the Romans themselves. So Florus, Sallust, Seneca. And Cicero himself as a politician, Cato was a politician as well, actually, for that matter, Cato the Elder, that is, who basically said or reflected upon the Romans and made the observation that the riches that we are bringing in are spoiling the traits that make us what we are. You know, the wealth of, for instance, when Rome annexed the kingdom of Macedon, I believe Rome trebled or quadrupled the size of its treasury. And once Rome became wealthy, that's when it started importing these luxury goods, which were sort of essentially not really known in Rome, but they were actually actively rejected by Rome, because the idea of luxury and the idea of, you should say, sating desires was not considered a Roman virtue. And it is some of those qualities that made the Romans as sort of determined and particularly on the battlefield, they were gritty and determined and unyielding and tenacious, more so than their enemies, whoever they confronted, whether it was the Gauls or the Etruscans or the Samnites or whoever. They prevailed against them all because they had sort of these qualities that were sort of innate to them, or that they cultivated very, very early on in their history. But then as they become more successful, they spurn these traits, these virtues, shall I say. And even though Rome...
The funny thing is, we can see this in our own civilization today, that the traits which our grandparents would have taken for granted, and certainly great grandparents, are falling away visibly by the decade. That there's a difference in public conduct. There's a difference in how celebrities behave. There's a difference in how articulate politicians are. There's as I was saying earlier, there's a difference in the prevalence of the concept of honor in our society. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of these 100%. Things are falling away. Visibly, literally visibly.
And not just falling away, but in many cases, actively spurned, actively rejected, are demonized as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, the word honor, honorable, that now seems sort of laughable. It's sort of embarrassing to say such a thing. You can imagine people scoffing at you for being so old-fashioned as to believe in something like that.
Yeah.
Or even beauty. I mean, if you were to say to, you're going to and the art world today and to talk about beauty, they'd think that you were lowbrow, naive, uneducated, unsophisticated, silly, and really not with the program.
Yeah, or bigoted and retrograde and
that sort of stuff. Indeed. Yeah. That, yes, indeed. That I'm probably not up to date enough. You're probably right. If you went into the art world today and talked about beauty, they would probably immediately think, hold on, are you a white supremacist by any chance?
Yeah, essentially, right. I suppose to cleave to your point, because I sort of have elaborated probably too much already, you know, if you're familiar with history, you would know that, you know, or you at least you'd have an idea or a conception of that. And so, as you rightly say, we're going through a phase now where the virtues and the traits and the principles and values which our predecessors held to be true, and not just our grandparents and great-grandparents, but, you know, in the case of the modern-day West, I mean, this could go back several centuries. I mean, to sort of quote someone who's obviously quite popular in our circles, you know, like Evola, you know, I can't remember the way he said this exactly, but, you know, I believe what was sort of sane and rational and every well-adjusted person believed prior to the French Revolution, you know, like essentially those kind of normative values that were sort of held as a social expectation, you know, many years in the past, indeed, in this case, several centuries, up until, you know, you could say the Second World War and a few years afterwards, where already you sort of see people in the, you know, like the 50s and 60s, essentially warning us in the future that you have this malignancy within our society that is going to attack these things. I always think of those black and white videos from the USA in like the 50s and 60s. And I can't remember if it's like the John Birch Society, whoever it is. And they already sort of lay out that, you know, according to leftist manuals, the moment you express, you know, a traditional ideal or, you know, like a any kind of patriotic sentiment, they're going to label you as, you know, Nazi, fascist, etc. And they knew this back then. And, you know, you might say the what I like to call the dinner table conservative, or, you know, like the wet centrist or whatever, have ignored these warnings and just tried to play the game as the regime has sort of laid it out, and have just lost, you know, to sort of quote that wonderful, you know, they've become beautiful losers.
Yes, indeed. And this was really the point, one of the points of my essay this year, Aryan Blues. I'll just plug that now. I was very proud of it. I am very proud of it. And it was making this point that conservatives have tried, as you say, to play the game. They have not led the game. They have tried to play it. They've played the game according to their opponents. They play the game that their opponents have fashioned for them. And of course they have, it has not only have they lost, it has utterly worked against them. Layer upon layer. You know, it's become worse and worse for them by the decade, because all of their options are cut off. You know, if you agree that the Nazis were bad, and that and that means racism is bad, and that means that any sort of white preferential anything like that is bad, and you agree that the war happened because of racism and so forth, then it leaves you with no option but to say, okay, yeah, we should import Infinity Africans into Britain, into Australia, and so on, and you have no grounds upon which to object.
Absolutely right, and it does eventually corner oneself into that place, unless one then chooses to just not adhere to the rules of that said game, which is a rigged game. You know, it's like sort of, you know, walking to a casino and hoping to pull the jackpot on the slots machine. There's never, you know, there's a reason why the casinos are full of slot machines, because the odds are always against you. And the other thing that's worth mentioning too, just sort of reflecting what you said, is that, you know, our people, so to speak, or, you know, like conservatism writ large, has failed in the face of this. But that's also to presume that much of the opposition to the left has been genuine and sincere. As I have, you know, grown older and I suppose hopefully a little wiser, and particularly, and again, I have to plug our friend AA here, because I think some of the reading he does on Cigarstream is amazing. You know, and you listen to the reflections of these people who lived back in the, you might say the war period and immediately after the war, and were writing about this sort of from our perspective, retrospectively, that how much of this was a rigged game. You know, for instance, can you not but think that you know, William Buckley was batting for the opposition and was intentionally striking himself out so the Conservatives would lose on purpose, you know. I mean, why is it that, you know, like someone like, you know, Sam Francis and, you know, people like him just get, you know, pushed to the side by Dinesh D'Souza? I mean, none of that stuff happens by accident. There's a reason why the so-called right, you know, if we want to call it that, exists as it does today. It's sort of been a case of, well, the potters formed, you know, that to look like that. You know, people have made it that way. It's on accident. You know, certain people along the way, along all chains from the functionaries at the bottom to the elites up top, have made it so that this is the manifestation of the right wing in current year. And, you know, I suppose people like us grasp that. It's a little bit harder for perhaps people a generation or a couple generations before us, you know, like, you know, the boomers and so on, because for them, it sort of buys into the lie of, oh, freedom, democracy, this is the West, etc., which is, sorry to tangent on you, boys, but that's another point I just want to make to your viewers, and I think it's an important one, is that never, ever, ever let, if you're in discourse or, you know, discussing this with people or whether it's friends or family or whatever, is that when people say, oh, the liberal democratic West, it is your place to actually dismiss that, because our systems of government and the presiding ideology is not what we are. It is simply how we manage our affairs. What is more important is, what is our civilization and what comprises that civilization? What is the West? What is the Occident?
Yes, you know, I completely agree with you. I think this is a very good point that you're making here.
And we need to make that distinction so clear, because very few people do, you know? And the thing is, you know, even to the point where I'd even use like Christianity as like a stage two aspect to that, because what we actually have is a sort of a Greco-Roman civilization that has been, how can I put this, sort of intertwined with characteristics that are Teutonic, that are Anglo, that are sort of Celtic and Brythonic, and have made the West what it is. And those cultures are the bedrock of this civilization that we now sort of commonly understand to be the West. And, I mean, frankly, you know, I think Christianity, I mean, I know there are people in our spheres who sort of have an opinion either side to that, you know, people who are very, very religious from a Christian standpoint or reject Christianity because they think it's, you know, to take the Gibbon perspective of it caused the fall of Rome. Again, that's nuance and that's probably another discussion for another day. But the point is that you can sort of superimpose a religion on that, but, you know, you can take or leave the religion to an extent. Like, ultimately, that isn't civilization. I mean, for instance, you know, like would Mozambique be categorically different if they were Zoroastrian than what it is today? You know, would Sri Lanka be monumentally different if they were Shinto? I don't think the fundamentals of that culture and that people can be hugely transformed by what faith they follow.
I don't know. I think it would, it's a bland answer, but I think it would have to depend on the particular situation. I can imagine a country somehow taking on a religion that was radically different and required it to radically change. But in the case of the West, what we live with today, I know one, I have a very good friend who believes that Christianity is absolutely central to the West and fundamentally important to the formation and of the West and its character today. Mm-hmm. I suspect that we adapted Christianity to work for us. I think it's the other way around, you know. I think that we made it amenable, suitable for us.
Or it could be aspects of both.
No doubt it is. I mean, the truth is, both are true. But I think the point that you're making is that we have to get back to something that is fundamentally us and understand that we are doing that all along anyway. We are fundamentally us, and the democratic system that we live, the system of governance that we live under, is almost incidental. That will affect our day-to-day lives, but it doesn't. It's not an automatic reflection of us, and it doesn't change.
Correct. I would even argue slightly further is that to even counter people who will insist on that point, as erroneous as it is, I would even say to them, or what I employ your audience to sort of suggest, is that, you know, as a sort of a counter to the counterpoint, is that ask them or insist upon the fact of making them state, when do you consider the zenith of Western civilization to be? And if it isn't either to some degree, like the height of the Roman, you know, of the Roman civilization, or if it wasn't, say, the Renaissance, or if it wasn't, say, pre-World War One Europe, right, then I hate to say it, they're wrong. You know, if you look at the overall sum of scientific achievement, which matters to a point, but that doesn't define a civilization in itself, it's literature, it's philosophy, it's capacity for, you know, creativity, and for the fostering and maintenance of an acceptable standard of living that, you know, at least people like us could reflect upon, for its military capabilities, for its orientation towards spirituality and the maintenance of pro-social and pronomian virtues and values that ensure a salubrious society that's, you know, is objectively good. Very few of these occur under the auspices of a modern democratic representative governmentarian system. They occur under some degree of kingship or imperium. It's the Kaiserreich in Germany. It's the, you know, Austro-Hungarian Empire to an extent, particularly in its more or less like a later iteration. You know, it's potentially the British Empire prior to the prior to World War One as well, to a point. It's, you know, it's ancient Rome, it's aspects of ancient Greece, it's the Byzantine Empire, it's Renaissance Italy. And I mean, yes, people say, oh, but plagues and oh, but illiteracy, and it's like, okay, fine, that's all true. But one has to judge an epoch in the time at which it exists. And if you lived in the 1490s, would you rather live in Mantua or Milan or indeed Rome? Or would you rather live in Tasmania? Or would you rather lived in, Java? Or would you rather live in Senegal? I think the answer's obvious, you know?
Yes, yes, of course. Of course.
So, yeah.
I mean, I'm not arguing, by the way, that religion doesn't affect life, and it doesn't even have eventually genetic effects on a people. I'm sure that selection would ensure that would happen. But I think there is a fundamental nature of a people that transcends and outlasts the political and even religious changes that their society goes through. And that, yeah, they go through.
I mean,
and
so, exactly.
For example, and I think this is why Rome is still so interesting to people today, for example, to white men, specifically to white, I shouldn't say to people,
to European men.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's a reason it appeals to us, and it's fundamentally that we are still, in some sense, the same people or yearn to be the same people again.
Well, the very least descendants of, if not literally, then at least metaphorically.
Yeah, a continuation of. Yeah, a continuation.
We are inheritors in one way or another.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's, as I said earlier, that one of the crimes of today is that we deracinate ourselves and our young by not placing them in this greater historical context so that they think, you know, because it's very possible to have very false ideas and yet to believe them because you don't know any other ideas. So it's very possible for a European child today to be a continuation of Rome and yet not know that at all, have no awareness of what he actually is, and to instead see himself as, bound for that awful McDonald's that I showed earlier on the screen. You know, that's
the consumer of McProduct. Of McLeod, you know?
And doing his bit participating in a public health hazard with the mask, doing his bit for the NHS, and so forth. Yeah, it's very possible to see yourself in that way, but it's not true, and it's certainly not helpful for yourself.
Indeed, and on that basis, it's actually worth taking to account that, as I sort of said before, that you know these circumstances have been made or have been sort of made to come to pass and are maintained by people who've sort of, you know, who've done this willfully, who've done this by design, who actually have an animosity and hostility towards, you know, ideals that are representative of occidental civilization, and that this is essentially an act of hostility whereby these creatures, because I refuse to call them people, have foisted this upon us and have usurped our institutions and have turned our institutions on us and have sort of essentially like a tsunami subsumed generations of young people in this sort of miasma, you know, whether it's a social miasma, whether it's an educational miasma, whether it's a but like all of the above, like whatever the vector is, it's music, it's television, it's movies, it's literature, and it's, you know, to some degree I actually sort of have to shake my head and just actually be appreciative to an extent that there are people like us who actually exist, who have sort of weathered the storm. One of the other points I know we've got on our checkbox there is, you know, people who become right-wing and those who are sort of are born right-wing, but, you know, that we somehow make it through this. And one of the great contentions I have is that I have a few interests. For people who've watched Apostolic Majesty's channel will know that, you know, I'm fairly well versed in the world wars, particularly World War II. I have a decent grasp, or rather, my first academic love was ancient Rome and ancient Greece, but I since sort of morphed into a Byzantist, which is more the medieval period. And I've read an awful lot about, you know, the Byzantine Empire and Constantinople, and that sort of coincides with the Crusader period, sort of, you know, by incident as much as anything. But, you know, and I've also studied sort of Napoleon to some degree of depth. But what's interesting is that, you know, one can go through 12 years of education or so-called education and not come across 95% of this content, which is such a, it's such a dastardly sort of condemnation. It's such a blight, an indictment, thank you, of our institutions and those who run them. And one can't help but think it is absolutely on purpose. Because one of the things I sort of do here, it's a very common trait amongst Australian boomers, is that, oh, you know, these lefties are there, you know, the idiots, and oh, these bonehead, you know, oh, the Labor Party, oh, they're a bunch of morons. It's like, no, they're not actually morons. They're the ones who strip you of tax dollars, have their hands on the levers of power, who indoctrinate your children, who levy tax on whatever possible, you know, streams of revenue you have, who make your life misery, who pump crap on your television, make you watch it, and have contaminated every sport that you used to enjoy with their ideological messaging. We are the fools, because we accept it and we endure it. And trying to alter the boomer mindset in that regard is actually quite difficult. But I actually want to, because we sort of harped on about boomers a little bit, I do want to make this point. And I think I got a feeling you and I probably aren't too dissimilar in age, because obviously I think we're both 80s kids, I think, if memory serves me correct.
Yes.
And I think maybe we... The good thing is we grew up at a time where we had a living memory and interacted with people who lived and experienced the world as it was before, if you get my meaning, right?
Yes.
Whereas sort of the later millennials, certainly the Zoomers and definitely the ones coming up now, the Alphas, have had that link severed. You know, they never got the chance to sit down and talk to World War One and World War Two veterans in the true sense of the word. And they, everything that's been handed to them in that respect is sort of second and third hand. But one thing that we should, and as such, they're the ones who are probably even harder on boomers than what we are. But one thing we ought to be cognizant of, and this is a video I will recommend of AA's, is the things that Yuri Bezmenov didn't tell you. And it goes to show that essentially the techniques which were conceived of by the Frankfurt School, essentially trialed in Germany after the World War II as a means of denazification, were essentially a testbed as what to do to everyone else. And the Anglosphere was particularly vulnerable to these techniques as a result of being, shall I say, liberal and democratic. And we should always be cognizant of the fact that the boomers were the first generations to be victim of this. And on that basis, we should be a little bit, thoughtful about that. We should almost be a little bit sympathetic towards it, because in the end, people like us have had the ability to, particularly, like in the pre-censorship days, we could, go on the internet and find forums and, listen to, this stream or that stream, or, read this blog or that blog or this forum or that forum about, shall I say, contentious subjects. And our curiosity brought us there at a time, where technology sort of opened that avenue for us. That wasn't true of our predecessors. And so a lot of the views that they hold dear to are baked into them. And I think that's very much true of the Anglosphere. It's true of Australia, New Zealand. It's true of Britain. It's true of America. And, what we call the boomer truth regime is very, very foundational to people who believe not only in the system, but that the sacrifices of their predecessors, as in those who fought in the wars, and by that I mean both wars, was valid and was moral and true. And that itself is emotional investment too. It's easy enough for, and I don't say this to dismiss young people. In many ways, I admire their intellectual curiosity and tenacity, and their, these younger people definitely think less of being coerced and intimidated by nasty words, and that I do respect. But it is worth, thinking that there are people who've come before you who haven't had that ability to access this information, who haven't had the freedom to explore these avenues, and also have an emotional investment. Like it's a little bit different when it's your dad who was in the 101st Airborne Division, when your dad was on the beaches at Normandy and was being sort of, hit with German shrapnel and machine guns. And, it was, your grandfather who fought at Stalingrad, you know what I mean? Sometimes it pays for people like us to be a little bit mindful of that. And I say that as someone who's my own grandfather fought in North Africa, obviously, on the Axis side. But at the same time, when he settled in the town that in the place that he did in Australia, it was actually Australian war veterans who used to invite my grandfather to their Remembrance Day ceremonies. So, it's a complicated subject is what I'm alluding to.
Of course it is. I think it would be worth going into what the boomer truth regime is. I mean, an academic agent has talked about this, and I believe he talked about it on Millennial 2 years ago, 21. But how would you describe it? It's always good to have someone else describe something, because you will do it in your own way. How would you describe that? How would you characterize it? What is it?
Well, in preparation, I probably should have actually listened to that so I don't go over what AA did as well. But I'll tell it from my own perspective of that, for instance, boomer truthism will essentially posit the idea that, one day for no reason at all, Mussolini and his goons marched on Rome, and then, a decade or so later, one sunny afternoon in 1933, the German people just, voted for Hitler because, they used propaganda and they, aroused the passions of the people, and they, they in a very bigoted and xenophobic way, like just targeted, minorities and all these groups who were just, absolutely innocent, and then they marched in this sort of insane, death wish towards war, and that, the German war machine geared up and, want to conquer the world. It's a very simplistic way of looking at it. And for the most part, it's actually incorrect, or at the very least, it lacks context and nuance, insofar that, for instance, if I take the Italian example, which is because that is one I'm familiar with, my family, obviously, agriculturalists in Australia, and that's what they also did in Italy. That's true on both sides of my family, actually. as both monarchists and, you know, and to use the Italian word, contadini, you know, farmers in Italy, had the socialists won, we would have suffered the exact same fate as the kulaks. And so a lot of different classes of people, you know, when offered with the choice, rationally chose to, you know, support the king and, I suppose, by proxy or as a consequence, consented to, you know, Mussolini's march on Rome and the establishment of his regime. And that is a contentious thing to say. I know that. But when one looks at what happened, not just even in Russia with the you know, the October Revolution and the Russian Civil War, but the attempt also, you know, we have the Spartacist uprising in Germany, you know, where, you know, Rosa Luxemburg and, you know, the Karl Liebknecht and Paul Levi and Kurt Eisner and, you know, all these Karl Radek and all these wonderful people attempt to quite literally stab Germany in the back, you know, right at its point of weakness in the immediate defeat of the German army in World War One. I suppose it was sort of by coincidence, you might say they probably did it a little too soon when there were still, you know, tens of thousands of veterans returning from the front, whom obviously put down the revolt. I mean, we know those people as the Freikorps. But already in Europe, there were several examples of what happens at, you know, of what extent the socialists and the Bolsheviks will go to win and how they treat their enemies. And the socialist movement was quite powerful in Italy immediately after the war. And so the Italians essentially had two courses to take. Do we become socialists or do we become something else? And that was a very hard decision to take. And a lot of people in, you know, current year will sort of sit down on their sofas, you know, with Dorito crumbs on their chest and, oh, well, actually, no, like, you know, this is, you know, oh, why would I choose evil? It's just like, well, you know what I'm trying to allude to, was, you know, it's always caricatured as being this sort of, you know, everyone's going to be in the French resistance and everyone's going to be, you know, the hero who throws a Molotov cocktail at the Panzer. And it's just, it's a LARP, you know, and it's actually bullshit. And it's also, you know, from people who don't often, not always, but often don't have or possess anything of value. And, you know, for instance, sort of here with what happened in Australia during sort of COVID, and then you might be aware, Woz, because I know the Lotus Eaters boys talked about it a couple of times, that Australia, we had this referendum recently about The Voice, and a couple of states already had attempted or kind of had implemented their own thing. And then in Western Australia particularly, they had this thing called the Aboriginal Heritage Act, whereby I think it was it came into force, I think it was June 1 this year, or July 1, sorry, this year, that if you were to dig more than 5 meters below the surface of the soil, you actually needed, like, consent from your local Aboriginal kind of representative entity, whatever that is, because that is totally ambiguous and amorphous, to do anything. Like, you know, if you wanted to just build a fence on your property, sorry, you can't do it. If you want to build a bridge over a creek, you can't do it. Essentially, if you were a landowner, your hands were tied. Again, this is that sort of anti-Kulak sentiment of the left, right? And that's the degree to which they will go to eventually strangle you into either submission or to death, be it literal or figurative. You know, and such a reality was true in Italy with the strength of the socialist movement in Italy. And so, you know, the Italian people chose another course. And of course, the liberal democratic West would choose to demonize the Italian people for having done that. You know, and that's one of the essential sort of bedrocks of Boomer Truth, is to demonize anything which has ever stood against it.
Yes. Yeah. It's, well, that's one way of characterizing it, is to say that it's a sort of faith in the idea of democracy, even amongst the lie of democracy.
Precisely.
To believe in it as the US, like they always invoking that quote from Churchill, democracy is the worst system apart from all the others that we've tried.
Which is actually also bullshit. I hate that quote on the basis that it's so wrong. You know, it's just,
I just don't know how many times I've heard people saying that of a certain generation. So that I think is one of the tenets here. Okay, what we've got might be crap, and it might be working against us, and it might be ensuring our demographic extinction and so on, but it's the least, it's better than the alternatives. You know, would you rather be speaking German? And you know, increasingly the answer is, well, yes. If it meant that I existed, then yes, I would rather be speaking German. Call me crazy.
It's like, I'm sure, you know, because we sort of, people like us, our age, and I suppose like this includes AA and others that are sort of that, you know, you might say that perimeter between millennials and Xs, lived in that era where we sort of had like social media, where you had like the pre-meme memes, you know, like the motivational posters and that sort of stuff, and like you know, older style memes. Yeah. And one of the first ones I remember sort of seeing is like, was a picture of occupied France, and it's a group of French people, and I think, you know, men in German uniform walking out of the metro station in France, and like everybody's European and Caucasian, right? And then it's like Paris in, back then it would have been like 2016 or 15 or whatever it was, and it's just, it's literally, you know, you could have taken a portion of, you know, Ivory Coast or Ghana and just transplanted it into Paris, and that's what it was. It was just filthy, and there was rubbish everywhere, and you know, people sleeping on the street, and it was just disheveled, and you know what I mean. Like, this is what's happened to us, and this is evidence, and it's also got much worse since then. You know, the last 10 years have been quite unkind to Europe in this regard. But people like us, I mean, we should never be happy about what's happened, insofar that the consequences themselves are bad. You know, we should never relish the ill that he's done to us and to our countries and to our people. But take solace in the fact that these regimes, and we should call them regimes because they're not governments, they are regimes, are doing a expert job, a thorough job, you might say even an exceptional job, of discrediting themselves, and are actively proving that they are not fit for purpose. They do not safeguard the homeland. They do not protect the people. They are either unwilling or incapable or completely disinclined from defending the, you know, the tenets of that culture, that civilization, and the values which are, you might say, they're of perennial value to that society. It's just being all dispensed of. It's actually being, it's being demonized and it's being vilified. And those same, those who are doing that are also the same, you know, group who are, who have occupied essentially every institution of significance, and they've turned those institutions against the people, and they are actively mass importing, you know, vast quantities of foreigners to actively dispossess us and displace us and eventually genetically extinct us. We should bear that in mind. But it's got to the point now where I actually am of the belief that the genie's now out of the bottle. And I think those of us in our circles are doing an exceptional job of pushing this into the public consciousness and into, you know, and really presenting it to people who at least can be persuaded as to the reality of it, of showing them it's actually like, no, this is being done. Like, this isn't accidental. That, you know, oh, it's not that the Labour Party just stupid or that the Democrats are incompetent. They hate you. They hate you spiritually. They hate you genetically. They hate you culturally. They hate you sort of, you know, physically and metaphysically. They hate you in every conceivable way possible. They want you gone, and they, you know, and if they can, they'll conscript your children to the cause, or otherwise they'll destroy them as well. You know, and I say that in completely unabashed terms, because that's essentially what we're confronted with. But I dare say, and I have mentioned this before, particularly on AA shows, I think where there's this, like this sort of arms race between two sort of factors. One, with the inertia that they have and with institutional control, how much of this can they accelerate and bring about before the other consideration, which is, I think in some ways the left are being sort of, when I say the left, you know, the globalists, you know, the regime and the people, the creatures that populate the regime, they're being felled by their own biolinism, which I think is a factor, and also their own ineptitude, because the succeeding generations from those who created this system are nowhere near as intelligent or adept or insightful or, you know, even well-read or knowledgeable. You know, like, you know, we may hate these people, these individuals, but, you know, at least Marcuse was well-read and somewhat educated. You know, you could say the same for Adorno. You could say the same for Kissinger. You know, you could say the same for, you know, Wilson, President Wilson, or FDR, you know, whatever people you want to mention here, right? Like, at least they were, you know, smart and had a cogent sort of plan. Do you think that's true of those who populate the Democrat Party today? Do you think that's true of the Labour Party functionaries in other Britain or Australia? Do you think that's true of the of those who run Antifa or Greenpeace? No. They are actual idiots now. They're malevolent, but they're still idiots.
Yeah, they're certainly malevolent. I think it would depend on the individual thing. The political parties, I think, are just populated by more, by, well, yes, husks, who do what they are told. And they don't get in unless they're the type of person who will do as they're told.
Absolutely.
By and large. Now and then, you know, some loose cannon, a firebrand, slips through the cracks and does get in, like Andrew Bridgen, for example, in Britain. But mostly politicians are extremely conformist.
Absolutely.
Apart from anything else, they know that they'll lose everything and be blackballed and demonized in the press if they don't. So the political parties, no, I don't think they've got any long-term vision for society. The NGOs, Greenpeace, that's a different matter. But also, I don't think the political parties or even the national governments really have much power. It's really the NGOs, the globalist institutions that I think have much more power, much more authority, and are much more trusted and admired by the national politicians. I think those national politicians actually look up to those as sort of saviors and guides, mentors, because they know that they are morons. They know that their colleagues are morons. So they look up to the expert, the technocrats. Whether the technocrats are actually in charge and have a long-term vision for society is another matter. I think to some extent they do. But then that might just be something that they're allowed to do as a distraction to keep them busy by other people who are much more powerful than them. So I don't really know. I mean, it depends how imaginative or conspiratorial you want to be in terms of speculating.
Because that's quite the can of worms if we open it, isn't it? I mean,
But I think there is a long-term vision at some level. Whether it's realistic, whether it's actually going to happen is a different matter. I do think that the rise of China and the rise of Russia were not really, were, probably must have been anticipated, but weren't as prepared for as they should have been. And I definitely think that what's happened in Gaza over the last couple of months has not been well managed in terms of PR.
A genie out of the bottle moment, I dare say, was.
Sorry?
I dare say a genie out of the bottle moment as well in many respects.
Exactly, and it shouldn't have been. You know, if you had a competent
I've seen some discourse on Twitter I would not have imagined even 18 months ago. Not 12 months ago, to be honest.
Not even 6 months ago.
Yeah, but precisely. Yeah. I mean, I'm being optimistic, but you know what I'm getting at, you know. It's actually astonishing in some ways.
Yes, it is. And I think if we had a competent elite, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, why would they allow this? It doesn't serve their interests. It doesn't serve Netanyahu's interests. It doesn't serve Israel's. It doesn't serve the World Health Organization's interests. It doesn't serve the UN's interests for people to be now questioning Israel. So I can only think that, okay, this must have been incompetence. Yeah. So in that sense, they are.
And also the opening question of Zionism. I mean, there was a time where sort of the Z word is quietly hushed in, you know, corners, you know, amongst people who were like-minded, whereas I'm just sort of seeing it just being openly stated, you know, very openly on Twitter. And also to the point where there's actually a linking of Zionism to, you know, the state of Israel. And to imperialism and to doctrines of, you know, of spiritual or racial supremacy and all these sort of things, like the stuff that I would not have imagined in public discourse, even in recent, you know, times.
Indeed. Now, I should say that there is one way in which you could say it does benefit the things like the globalist institutions, that people start hating the idea of nationhood even more. They'll turn against Israel, but they'll turn against all borders and all that, in which case the alternative would be more globalism. So maybe in that sense, they are competent and they did allow this to happen because they thought, well, let the Zionists make fools of them, put them, well, let them step into the shit and everyone will hate them, and that will actually serve our interests, maybe.
I was going to say, this kind of sounds like amongst, I know, because I know that AA and Aura, I think Aura might have had a bet on this. It was like, is what's going to win, the Zayas or the Woke? Like, they're actually essentially in a battle for supremacy in this regard.
And you know, that I do think there's probably a lot in that. At the same time, though, as other people have pointed out, if you did want Klaus Schwab's version of utopia with the technocratic globalism and so forth, why would you import Infinity Africans? That's because they're not going to help. You know, they're not going to make our societies more functional. So I really don't know. It's the only thing that's definitely happening that with a long-term vision is that our societies are being browned up and blacked up. That's the only consistent thing here. And that white people are being demonized. And that the Israel conflict is now helping that to happen as well, because the Israelis are counted as white. So that is the only consistent thing here.
Yeah. But funny you talk about sort of the regime or you know, the powers that be sort of stepping in it. You know, I obviously probably, you know, it's probably best we don't get into this, because I know there are people even in our circles who have disparate views on this. But I think, for instance, if we can just look at this as an objective you know, like prima facie analysis. I mean, presuming, as I do, that the current predicament in Donbass, right, was an invention of the State Department and was a, you know, like an orchestrated plan of, you know, the likes of, you know, Victoria Nuland and Blinken and, you know, that cadre that exists in the Washington swamp, you know, to perhaps bring down, you know, a sort of near peer competitor and to sort of, you know, enlarge the GAE with the incorporation of Ukraine and whatever, and how believing in narrative and believing in PR and believing in hopes and dreams over, dare I say, a civilization that still holds pragmatism as a higher virtue, has backfired spectacularly. And that sometimes being confronted with the realities of a given situation is not the strength of those who have their hands on the levers of power at present. You know, it's one thing to, you know, bomb the, you know, to drop a MOAB on, you know, on some hill fort on the outskirts of Kandahar. You know, it's another to launch airstrikes on Gaddafi's, you know, quasi militia army in Libya. It's another, you know, sending the 101st Airborne into Fallujah in Iraq and toppling Saddam and all that. But a conventional war is a very different prospect. And I think the regime has been caught very off its foot like that, and has actually deeply, deeply damaged both its, I think it's damaged its reputation. I think it's damaged its standing amongst its own people and amongst the international community, if one places any value on that point. And I think it's also affected its own sense of self-belief. And moreover, I think it's actually affected the regime materially, insofar that, you know, we have to seriously take into account from a geopolitical standpoint that the nations which prescribe to the GAE essentially have crippled their own power of projection in the world itself, because essentially the stuff that they use to project that power is now, you know, smoldering bundles of ruins, you know, on the steps of the Ukraine. And it's our elites that have done that, you know, essentially without our consent. I mean, they did corral a lot of enthusiasm for that war one way or another. But I think what we've seen there is probably one of the most catastrophic missteps of the regime in modern history, certainly in living memory.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Compared to 3 years ago, or even a year ago, the regime now seems much more fragile and precarious than it did. I think Ukraine has ended up with a bloodied nose for Ukraine, and now Israel, get the Gaza thing. And as a result, we're not hearing much about the Great Reset either. That really does interest me, how that's just fallen away, apparently. Now, I'm sure that it's still going on behind the scenes. That wouldn't surprise me if they're still making moves. But they're not doing so proudly anymore. You know, 3 years ago, remember that, I don't know how it played out in Australia, but here, I think it was by May, or in the middle of May, that Klaus Schwab was suddenly everywhere. And it was like 2 months into COVID, or less than 2 months. And I'd never seen this guy before. I don't think anyone had. And suddenly he's there talking in this very ominous tone. This old man who's not pleasant, not palatable. And he seems sinister. And that all happened. And now it's fallen away. That really does interest me. I think in terms of competence, they looked really competent. And in some ways, they were and clearly are. In terms of bureaucracy, they can absolutely create the system they want to limit your freedoms, your liberties. But in terms of actually getting things done, I don't know. Remember the migrant crisis in 2015? That must have been incredibly difficult to orchestrate. Mm. Must have been an amazing logistical operation to make that happen. But it was done. It happened.
Yeah.
That's right. So they have those abilities. But I think in other ways they don't. And perhaps it does all boil down to they don't actually have a vision for the future. Even all the happy clappy ukulele videos that they do are really just about resources. They don't actually know how to animate people at a spiritual level because they don't operate at that level.
Mm. Well, that's a plane of existence they've actually flatly rejected. And so there's a vacuum there, which again, I think offers an avenue of opportunity for people like us. It's like, yes, we actually do attend to the spiritual and the transcendental. And, you know, we do have aspiration towards beauty and to these things which ignite the human spirit and sort of, you know, and enlighten our minds and, you know, drive our sense of imagination, both at the individual level and then, you know, which is if you can imagine the lowest plane or the lowest, you know, I know I'm saying something here that's a bit almost trite, but, you know, civilizations even are made up of, you know, a large number of individual people. And it's important to have that drive at the individual level, but it's also important to have that drive at the meta level, at the civilizational level, you know. It's, and I think that the worldviews that people like us embody attend to that, whereas, you know, I mean, really, let's think about it. How appealing is you'll learn nothing and be happy whilst the leftist voter does his, you know, soy grimace, you know?
Yeah. It's, oh, I mean, even, you know,
it's horrific.
Yeah, the thing is, it even sounds bad. It even sounds horrible. Like they might as well have said, because you'll be drugged or something like that. The soma will make you happy.
Yeah. You'll be in the Matrix with an IV and you'll be happy, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds awful. And I think that links with the final point that you wanted to talk about, which is the importance of being aspirational and of valuing beauty, sentiment, and in maintaining spiritual balance and high morale. That would be a nice thing to end on. And I do think that we've learned over, I think in 2020 especially, people were living without this kind of thing completely. And the memory of that is going to remain for a long time. People in our movement knew this long before, that there needs to be a point to it all, and there needs to be something uniting us all, binding us together, and there needs to be a sense that there is more than the material. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Just before we get to that, because there was a dot point about like the whole farming thing, which I sort of wanted to touch on, which kind of bridges onto this, if I may.
Oh yeah, sorry.
But it's no, of course. But it's a thing that I think as for myself, I've lived a privileged life in the true sense of the word, of that I got to live a good life, and that if I sort of reflect on my childhood, it was pretty idyllic. That wasn't without its difficulties and without its, you know, problems, and, you know, didn't have its own sufferances. And, you know, people, you know, may or may not know this, but to be a successful farmer means that you work hard. And, you know, the vast majority of my family did work awfully hard. I mean, you know, and if you grow up on a farm, particularly in a place like Australia where farms are quite large and expansive, then, you know, if you're 7, 8 years old, chances are you're riding on a motorbike driving livestock, as, you know, myself and my cousins and siblings all did. I mean, it's just what you did on a farm. It was sort of par for course. It was sort of seen as a duty and a sort of an objective kind of, you know, almost an expectation that, you know, families help each other. And to some point, some people might help take slack for others that, you know, if you're unwell or you got a problem or whatever, then yes, you know, family helps out. But then at the same time, if you're sort of fit and healthy, then you pull your weight. And that is possible amongst people that have a culture of, you know, shared duties and responsibilities and live with a degree of reciprocity as a, you know, matter of their inherent mindset. That's important. And it's also good to learn to work with people whom you're close to, insofar that it's possible. The other part of it too is observing, sort of two things. This will sound hypocritical, me saying this, but it does strangely exist, or at least used to exist in a certain way, is that on one hand, you observe, you know, if you're plugged into these things and you know what to look for. Very early on, I became sort of clued in to the malevolence of, you might say, the global corporate sort of, you know, the corporate mindset of certain aspects, but even, for instance, of the agricultural industry, or certainly industries that plug into agriculture, you know, whether it's the companies that sort of mass produce, you know, like herbicides and insecticides, and, you know, the kind of things that are presented to farmers, like, oh, you have to farm this way, and this is the only way, and this is the only way you can achieve maximum productivity, and, you know, the whole big line go up kind of thing. You know, meanwhile, one of the things that I've been most applauded by, and I lived through this in my own town, and I mean, my town is like almost every other town in Australia that has suffered this kind of atrophy, whereby, you know, you start at a school where there's 100 pupils, and then by the time you graduate, you know, it's the numbers have decreased 70% or 50%, or, you know, you have a few dozen students left over because people have just left the town. You know, farms have sold up. Farmers can't make ends meet. You know, some, again, this is probably where, you know, you just have inherent inequality in people. Some people are better farmers than others. Some people are more ambitious than others. Some people are, you know, have better judgment than others. And that's true in all businesses and all, entrepreneurial endeavors, and agriculture no different. But nonetheless, the conditions have become increasingly hostile, where sort of costs and inputs have increasingly gone up. And then to sort of touch on the political dimension a little bit, the so-called political parties that, you know, or even if not the parties themselves, at least the representative bodies that exist, you know, like these sort of federations and co-ops and, you know, lobby groups and whatever. It's like, oh, they're meant to sort of represent us at the political level. For instance, one of the big controversies in Australia is live export, because we have a history of exporting beef and, well, particularly beef and like lamb and mutton, you know, sheep to foreign markets, particularly to the the Middle East, and particularly to South Asia. And basically, whenever a leftist government gets in, they ban it. And whenever sort of like our Tories, or the equivalent of our Tories, get in, they unban it for a time, and then it just gets rebanned. And it's this political handball. And the left will get in and say, oh, well, we're listening to all the stakeholders and all interested parties, which just means they're kept kowtowing to, you know, the minority of loud activists and, you know, the kind of people we dislike. But then, you know, when the so-called Tories get in, they don't ever sort of say, well, we're bringing this back and we're going to actively prosecute those who affect the lives of our constituents. No, they just sort of reintroduce it in a sort of a tepid way. And then whenever it gets banned again, they just sort of, oh, well, we'll fix it when we get in. You know, there's never any kind of conception of political power and how power functions at, you know, at the institutional level. It's either ignorance or it's just willing complicity in the agenda, shall I say. And so as a result of this sort of handball, I've witnessed this tragic atrophy in my own community, and it's hardened my view to the fact that we do live in a system that is actually hostile to living a good life and to nurturing communities and fostering healthy, sustainable communities of the kind of people who have built this civilization and have built these nation states, particularly in the New World. Like, you know, America, Australia, New Zealand are examples of the Anglosphere being sort of transplanted in the so-called New World, and have built, up to recent times, relatively successful, prosperous societies. And one would argue perhaps the more materially prosperous they've become, they've become more spiritually bankrupt. But we touched on that earlier on in the discussion with Rome. But the other, the positive aspect of it is that I was sort of raised in a wonderful family environment. Like I said, I have very fond memories of my upbringing in my childhood and living in sort of like this family unit where, you know, the men and the women had a symbiotic relationship with each other, and the men would work in the fields and, you know, would do the droving and would, you know, do the harvesting and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And, like, you know, the women would tend to the home, and they'd be, you know, and they were good mothers, and they were, you know, attentive mothers, and, you know, we were always, you know, nourished and well fed, and we were, you know, even at home, like, you know, our mothers read stories to us and nursery rhymes, and you know, we as kids, you sort of, you know, you're active around the house, you play out, you've got tons of space to play in, and then, you know, when you're in the house, you know, you watch like a wholesome cartoon, and then you're sort of helping mum in the kitchen. Like it's a really idyllic existence, and you learn about how things ought to be, and that, you know, as a farmer, you understand that there are cycles to the seasons, and there are cycles to life. And, you know, at a young age, for instance, I sort of remember, because, you know, we obviously had livestock on our farm, is that yes, there comes a time in a year where you take the fat lambs and you take them to the yards, and you select good ones and not so good ones, and the ones that are prime you take to the slaughterhouse, and, you know, you do the business, you know, you obviously kill them, and then you process them, and you have carcasses, and then, you know, you process the meat and you butcher them, and that's your meat supply for the year. And it's, you know, it's obviously not pleasant insofar that taking life is not a pleasant thing to do, but, you know, the sheep eat the pasture, they help manicure the paddocks, and then the sheep poop in the paddocks and they help nourish the soil, and with their hooves they agitate the topsoil. And the same is true of cows, obviously to a different extent. And then we eat them, but because they're a domestic breed, they can't survive in the wild. We as farmers justify the existence of domesticated creatures, right? And they help us maintain a farm, and they help nourish us, and then provide us profit. It's not this, you know, disgusting, soulless, you know, thing that, like, for instance, I actually quote tweeted Destiny actually only this morning. I might actually read it if I can find it. But it's this idea that, oh, no, you just purely eat meat for pleasure. Yes, meat is delicious and meat is tasty and whatever. But, you know, if you actually want to live a healthy life, you actually need to eat meat. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why nutritionally and from the standpoint of, you know, of biology, you actually require meat, because it contains many essential nutrients that you can't get from non-animal products. And farmers provide that, right? And we provide that in symbiosis with, you know, of managing a farm. Animals are a very vital, play a very vital role in that, to especially to sustainable farming. What is wrong is that there's like this mass consumer industrial aspect, particularly like say with pork, for instance, and chickens, which is quite inhumane and quite, you know, I would use the word soulless and very, you know, just like hideous on many levels, which I don't prescribe to and I don't agree with. But many, many farmers don't go down that avenue. Many other farmers choose not to go down that avenue. And we're sort of looked over as being, you know, all complicit in this disgusting regime. You know, this part of McCorp, you might say. But there are a large number of farmers who don't. And when you live in that environment, you actually understand that cycle and that symbiosis. And then I guess the point is then it offers an insight as to what actually living a good life is, broadly speaking. And that people like us have a right to be cynical of urbanism. We have a right to be cynical about, you know, being corralled into these massive skyscrapers and living in an apartment, and it's like yourself and your, you know, your polyamorous girlfriend with OnlyFans and like a chihuahua. Like, that's not living in an ideal way. That's actually antithetical to being human in many respects. I could go on, boys, but I think those things are important.
Yeah, I think it's a well-known thing. People say it a lot, that some of the most well-balanced people are people who grew up on a farm, because it instills a realism and a sense of, not just a sense of connection to the land, but also a sense of how things actually work in the real world, how reality works, how nature works. And I remember hearing, there was a phrase that I read it somewhere, that whenever I see a farmer's daughter, I in front of me, I know I'm looking at a well-rounded, like a top quality woman. interesting phrase. I think it was in one of my groups that someone said that, because farmers' daughters tend to be, you know, responsible, kind, not self-obsessed, not shallow, realistic, and so forth. Now, the opposite extreme of this is, as you say, someone who's entirely dependent on a system that they don't understand. It's so complicated that they don't stand a chance of ever grasping it. And that instills all sorts of delusions in them about how reality works, how resources are found and brought to them, and the quantities, what is possible and what is not possible. And it instills an awareness that it's important to understand what is possible and what is not possible. You have to be realistic. That kind of understanding comes naturally when you grow up on a farm. It doesn't come naturally at all when you don't. It's very much one very extreme and the other, I think.
Absolutely.
The more detached we are from this kind of thing, the more impractical and utopian our ideas tend to be.
And also they're sort of detached from any sort of notion. They're not moored to any degree of either pragmatism or sort of realism in that, you know, like, for instance, as a farmer, you know that if you don't, for instance, manicure certain parts of the farm, and particularly if you live in a sort of somewhat forested area, or to use the Australian analogy, like, you know, living amongst the bush, shall I say, you know, when it comes to summertime, and if there's a either, because usually fires will start out of two ways. One, or unless someone lights them, which is arson, but that's a separate thing. You know, it'll either be a lightning strike as a result of a thunderstorm, or it'll be a machine failure that occurs in a paddock, and then there's an ignition amongst, you know, straw or whatever, and or fuel or whatever, and it just, you know, creates a fire. And I mean, my dad and my uncles have fought several of them, and I've fought a few of those kind of fires myself, and they're quite unpleasant in like 40 odd degree weather. They can be quite dangerous, and I think farmers are very brave to, when they sort of corral together and you know, fight each other's fires, as very much an expression of community spirit that is, sadly, I find, on the descent and becoming rapidly extinct. You know, where people look out for each other in that regard, in a voluntary sort of almost mateship kind of way. But the fact is that, you know, if you don't manicure paddocks, you don't, you know, clean up your fields, and, you know, make sure the trees don't overhang too much or whatever, that you make yourself more vulnerable to fire. And that's also true if you don't do that around your homestead. You might actually lose your home. You might even lose your family if one is conscientious of those risks and addressing them through diligence and hard work. You know, it's not just something you can shrug your shoulders about and go like, oh, it doesn't matter. It does matter. And there are multiple consequences for being wrong.
Yeah. One other thing, of course, is the connection between effort and reward. The relationship between how much work you put in will govern how much you get back. Barring precisely exceptional interventions, so that
because nature can be cruel.
Realism,
and that's also to accept too the fact that nature is cruel. You know, like, for instance, a good example would be what happened in Queensland about sort of 12 or so years ago. They got massive. Actually, there's flooding in Queensland right now, but Queensland had massive floods. I think it was around 2010 thereabouts, right? Which is actually funny because, like, the western half of the country was dry, and the other half of the country was inundated, almost underwater. And, you know, no matter where you were, if you're a farmer in Queensland or Western Australia or New South Wales, you know, you worked for 12 months, or more actively 9 months, to plant this crop. You know, you seeded it, you fertilized it, you know, you applied, you know, your spray, you got, you manage your weeds, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then for that crop to be ruined, it's either dried out or it's flooded. And imagine working a calendar year for no reward. Farmers do that often, and it's a massive, massive burden to bear, and it's a large risk to take, both commercially and even just from the standpoint of running a family. Like, farmers need to put food on their own table as well. They need to send their kids to school. They have their own costs to bear in life. And I think a lot of people, for instance, you know, like we talk about urban types, really underestimate the risk factor of the agricultural sector and the effort people go to make the whole food system work. It's rather more complicated and complex than people give them credit for.
Yeah. Definitely, as I say, people are. I think we live very unnatural lives, very detached from the way things are. And that in turn leads to all manner of psychological imbalances.
And dysgenia.
Mental illnesses. It's bad. And I think it's well known. You know, the urban people are more prone to mental illnesses, the depression and so forth. It's obvious. And you can understand why that happens. It's sort of common sense. And of course, I think this really pisses off liberals, because they want to despise the rural, the earthy.
They hate kulaks.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We're behind schedule, so we'll get to the super chats. And Noogie said choo choo. I think that's a reference to the train. So thank you very much for that. The train does seem to be popular with people. I'm relieved.
If you're not train pilled, you're not a true right winger. I'm sorry, but there's only one thing that's more indicative of someone who's right wing, and that's if you're Zeppelin pilled. Like, the train is number two and the Zeppelin's number one.
All right. Maybe next time, says democracy is the best form of governance money can buy.
Very yes. True.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, would you rather buy a king or would you rather buy a parliament?
Exactly. There's a whole load of stuff that could be said about that, but we don't have time. Soccer City, dare we think of a best case scenario in 2024? May I suggest starting with a major crisis in Israel and a right-wing resurgence in America? Maybe the collapse of Ukraine leading to a collapse of NATO and or the EU. Can we dare to dream? Furious Partanax, best case scenario for this time next year, the end of 2024?
Well, I suppose, because I sort of went on a bit about farming more than I should have done, but I suppose I can sort of touch on that last point, you know, where you said about like high morale and this sort of thing. I think we should always expect the worst and we should hope for the best. And that's not to say that we should be delusional. We should not be, right? However, we should celebrate W's when they come. I think be wary of those who are always prepared to be the killjoy and to be defeatists at every possible thing. There's a balance to be had between, yes, our situation is dire. Yes, this could be a psyop. Yes, this person could be a grifter. All of that can be true. One should observe general trends that go in our direction. And we should always, to some degree, hold enthusiasm for the weakening of the system that despises us and hates us and actively makes our lives hell. That should always be, embraced, shall I say. One thing I'd want to touch on about positivity is that, because I did actually want to reflect on your show, was because like when we sort of started this chat, I sort of said that, you know, I've been watching Millennial for years, and I sort of remember like the halcyon days of, you know, 2015, 16, 17, and, you know, having all these guests and whatever. And, it's a real cozy kind of experience. You know, these things I think are truly, truly wonderful, and they should be nurtured and encouraged, I think, to the utmost. Because, I mean, in the end, you know, there is such a thing as standing around and just engaging in a circle jerk and not actually achieving anything. That's all true. And it's important that people do things in their real lives, you know, whether it's, you know, like building a successful business and being able to employ friends, or whether it's being able to be productive or securing yourself, or, you know, building a family, or, you know, engaging in some kind of proper academia or scholarship that helps extrapolate, you know, what we do and get our ideas out there. All of that is completely valid, and I 100% encourage that. But it is also worth taking into account that we also are ourselves a community. And I mean, speaking for myself, I'm kind of lucky. I've got, thankfully, a handful of IRL friends who are, I would, you know, consider them very much a cadre, and they're, you know, very like-minded, and I have that around me. And indeed, I actually have family who are, you know, very supportive as well in that respect. Not everyone is. There are many, many people who are alone, or who, you know, are a black sheep amongst their family, or, you know, whatever the situation is. And we have to bring everyone else along. And not everyone is as fortunate as everyone else. You know, in the end, we are people who believe in, you know, stratocracy and hierarchy, and, you know, we believe in inequality. And there are some people who are better off more than others. And we need to bring each other along. That's called camaraderie. That's called, that's called sort of, to use the Australian analogy, like mateship. You know, it's about having that sense of belonging and community that is, you know, voluntary. It's like, yes, we are going to support each other because it is the right thing and because we are dutiful. It is moral to do so because that's what it means to be good. And I think whether it's millennial or whether it's, you know, I mean, we haven't done, I don't think it really happened last year, but I know like in the last couple of years, you know, Semigog did a round table, AA did a round table, you know, and we shoot the shit every so often. You know, we have fun, whether it's amongst ourselves as the commentators and the content creators, or whether it's the people who listen to us and who are our fans and our friends. Like, we need to do this because maintaining morale is important. When you think of the gravity of what's before us, when you think of just the really, like, how much power and the scale of you know, both the challenge in front of us and then those who have their hands on levers of power, it's astonishing. It's almost stupefying to comprehend. And we're just like this thorn in their side. You know, it's important that we don't lose faith, you know, and not to delay ourselves, we might lose. You know, we might be those 7,000 Greek soldiers standing on the Theodosian walls of Constantinople with the Ottoman army bearing down on us. But that doesn't mean you just give up and throw your weapons away. It doesn't mean you just surrender. It doesn't mean you just, you know, throw yourself on the ground bubbling and crying. Living a good life in contradiction to that is important. Being joyful and finding reasons to be contented and happy and to strive for fulfillment is important. It actually gives you a prospect and a chance of winning, and it helps brighten those that are around you. There are some people who will flag in their faith and their confidence and their belief either in self or in a higher ideal, and we have to hold hands with each other and bring each other along. That is the best thing that we can do, even if we don't succeed. I pray tell that we do, but even if we don't, at least we can say to ourselves we left nothing on the table, and if we do win, all the better.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't disagree with a word of that. I think it's very important that we do what we can to not create a bad atmosphere, to try to create a good atmosphere, and try to support each other, and of course to be as self-sufficient as possible, so that we're not a drain on others. Correct. This is all important.
Yeah.
Please take these words to heart. Okay. Well, one person said, Magic Man said, a great guest was well chosen. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to say.
Okay. This has been great. So, Furious, this is your debut on Millennial. So, I think many people enjoyed it. I certainly did. So, excellent. I'll be back very soon with Black Pilled. In the meantime, Furious.
May I apologize to Black Pilled? I'm sorry that we went over. So, like I said, I know I'll sandwich between two excellent people, and it was lovely to have obviously Uncle Jared before me. So, thank you, Woz. I want to thank you in your chat. This has been spectacular, and I hope we can repeat our conversations. I feel that we have a lot to share. You know, we're on a similar plane in many ways, so I really, really appreciate it. So, thank you, my friend.
Yeah, certainly, certainly. And thank you to you, Furious Partanax, for appearing on Millennial 2023. I'll be back very soon. Until then, bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.